The next morning, Jury was awake before Kate left for once, which gave Kate an opportunity to apologize.
I got too involved in the discussion, she said to Jury's reflection behind her own in the closet door mirror as she knotted her ribbon tie.
I shouldn't have preached at you at the end there, about not trying to control everything.
Jury smiled.
It was a bit rude of you, she said, but you had the somewhat redeeming quality of being right.
As Kate gave a sheepish smile, Jury went on,
I know I try to dictate the course of my life more than is really healthy. It's an unfortunate side effect of my belief in an orderly, rational universe, every effect with its cause.
Stay out of conversations with Megazone, Kate advised Jury's reflection.
I'm glad you're not offended, she added, turning to face the real Jury.
Again the pause, again the touch of pink in her cheeks.
I enjoyed the argument. I think we really connected.
She looked at her watch, then said,
I've got to go. I'll be late. Today is the last workshop day. Tomorrow we have the morning off, then prep for the concert in the afternoon, then the concert at 7. Are you coming?
Jury nodded, smiling.
I wouldn't miss it. Have a good last day. Try not to strangle Regulin.
Kate rolled her eyes, said she would refrain with Aunt Belle's help, and left. While she was window shopping along the Boulevard Saint-Germain on Thursday morning, Jury remembered that it was Caitlin's birthday. She supposed she ought to get the girl a present. After all, Kate had been nice enough to bring her along on this trip, which was proving most edifying in more ways than one, and after the previous night's highly civilized disagreement, Jury was even prepared to call her a kind of friend. She considered this as she made her way along the boulevard. What does one get a girl like that for her 16th birthday? Jury remembered turning 16. It hadn't been so long ago. But no one had known it except Miki. Well, and Toga. But Jury had informed Toga early in their acquaintanceship that if he ever gave her any sort of a gift, she would break his arm. Toga Kiryu generally hadn't taken seriously threats of bodily harm from women, but from Jury, he believed. While she waited to cross a side street, it struck her like a fist to the forehead. She was in Paris, the fashion capital of the Earth Alliance, one of the 5 or 6 cities from which the entire humanoid galaxy took its fashion cues. As far as Jury could tell, Caitlin possessed a grand total of 2 articles of clothing that weren't either school uniforms or something you would wear to paint the house, and both of them were suits that were almost comical in their severity. The black one was suitable for a funeral or a tax audit, and that was about all. The gray one wouldn't have looked out of place in a courtroom. Both made the poor girl look prematurely elderly. So, here was Jury in Paris, with money to burn, time to kill, and a friend in dire need of some fashion help. She went back to the Hotel des Deux Îles, read Caitlin's sizes from the tags of her clothes, and then got to work. By mid-afternoon, Jury felt she'd acquitted herself well, and also ridden on what felt like at least a quarter of the Paris metro system, hitting shops in no fewer than 9 of the city's 20 arrondissements. Shopping for someone else made for an interesting mental exercise, and she thought she'd done pretty well. She'd done her best to select things that she felt Kate would wear, if only she had the inclination to buy them, sticking fairly close to her own elegant but understated style in the process. The result was a range of modest but flattering cuts, non-aggressive colors, but with an underlying structure that would subtly call attention to the hidden dimensions that lurked within the quiet girl with the pretty smile. At least that was the theory. It remained to see how well it would work in practice. Jury concluded her last purchase in a boutique off the Rue Saint-Sulpice, made arrangements to have the things delivered to the Hotel des Deux Îles by 5 p.m., thanked the shopkeeper, and departed in high spirits. Mission accomplished, and without any of the famous Parisian snobbery to contend with. Her Gaulish wasn't quite the same as the French they spoke here, but the accent the difference gave her seemed to strike Parisians as enchantingly exotic rather than annoyingly provincial. She kept asking of her if she were Swiss, or perhaps from one of the colonies parmi les étoiles. Feeling curiously buoyant, Jury decided to walk back to the Île Saint-Louis instead of taking the metro. By the time she got there, she calculated, Caitlin's things should just about be arriving, and she could sort them and get them ready for presentation. As she made her way through the maze of little streets that made up the eastern end of the 6th arrondissement, Jury got a little lost, both in thought and in body. Presently she found herself in a narrow, twisty, deserted lane, almost an alley, but for the numbered doors and the lack of that rather distinctive alleyway atmosphere. She paused, looking back the way she'd come, and was about to turn and go back when a sign hanging next to the door she'd stopped even with caught her eye. Atelier de l'Escrime. Jury raised an eyebrow. A fencing studio. Very interesting. She went up the two narrow steps to the door, a heavy, old-fashioned affair painted green, and wondered if she should knock. As she considered it, the door opened, and she found herself face to face with a tall, thin, elderly man in fencing garb, his seamed old face wearing an inoffensive, curious look. Jury thought he looked remarkably familiar, but couldn't quite place why. "Yes?" he inquired. "Can I help you, miss?" "I noticed your sign," said Jury, her composure fully intact, "and was curious." "Ah," said the old man, his bushy white eyebrows rising. "You are a fencer? Indeed, I think I see it in the way you hold yourself. Come in, come in." "I don't wish to intrude," Jury began, but the fellow ushered her inside and shut the door behind her, smiling pleasantly all the while. "My name," said the old man as he led the way down a narrow hallway toward the back of the house, "is Emile, my dear. This is my little place." The walls of the hallway were covered with pictures. Jury slowed a little to look more closely at them. They showed a tall, lean man in fencing gear, dark-haired and mustachioed, always accepting trophies or medals on ribbons from beaming men and women in suits. With a shock, Jury recognized him in two different ways. One, he was this old man called Emile in his youth, and two, he was Charbonneau. Her old fencing teacher, who had taken her on as a student at the age of 7, the greatest fencer in all Sephiro, arrogant, often insufferable, but superbly talented, and an excellent teacher when he was in the mood for it. Jury had learned much from him before he'd lost his right arm and his will to live in an automobile accident, enough to make it onto the Ettore Academy fencing team in her first year at the school, the year after his death. But how could this pleasant old man be Emile Charbonneau? Letting aside the fact that he was alive and had both his arms, he was much too old. Charbonneau had been only perhaps 40 when Jury had started as his student a mere 10 years ago. "Parallel dimensions," she heard Caitlin say in her mind. "It happens. "Is something wrong, miss?" Emile wondered, jolting her out of her startled reverie. She blinked, recovered her composure again, and said, "No, sorry. I was thinking you looked familiar, and the pictures..." She gestured to the one she had stopped in front of, which was fortunately of him accepting a gold medal at the 2340 Olympic Games, and added a bit lamely, "You were sort of a hero of mine." She held out her hand to him. "I'm Jury." Emile smiled, took her hand, and rather ceremoniously kissed it. "I'm glad to know you," he said. "So people out in the world still know old Charbonneau's name, eh?" he added with a self-mocking twinkle in one dark eye. "Do they still talk about what a pain in the ass I was? You know, there was a time I wouldn't take a student if he couldn't speak French like a native." He shook his head. "Arrogance. I was almost as good at that as at fencing in my glorious youth. Ah, but you didn't come here to listen to the reminiscences of an old man." He led the way through the door at the end of the hall and into what turned out to be the studio itself, a large, airy room with plenty of light and windows, a fresh breeze, and a creaky hardwood floor. Épées, sabers, and foils hung racked along the walls. The floor was bare but for the well-scuffed piste. There was another door in the far wall, which jury guessed led to the showers.
"Are you a visitor to Paris?" Emile asked. "Yes," jury replied. "I'm a student at a school in America, the Worcester Preparatory Institute." "Ah," said Emile, raising his eyebrows. "I've heard of the place. Supposed to have an excellent fencing program." "I wouldn't know," jury replied wryly. "I have a bit of a personality conflict with the captain of the team, so..." She shrugged, a rather Gallic shrug. The place was rubbing off on her, just as it had on Caitlin, it seemed. "Ah," said Emile with a knowing nod. "Yet you keep in practice. I can see that looking at you. You have some like-minded friends, perhaps?" Jury nodded, and without really knowing why, she told him about the Duelist Society. "That sounds like quite a thing," said Emile thoughtfully. "I rather wish we'd had such a thing in my school days. To test my steel against Japanese fighters, against a Minbari warrior. What an experience that would be! What an opportunity you children have!" "Indeed," Jury agreed. "Although we aren't doing very much with it yet, we're still feeling our way. It's my hope that once we're all comfortable with the arrangement, we'll start living up to our charter." She sighed wryly. "Of course, I say that, and I don't even have a sword of my own. The one time I've fought so far, I had to borrow one from Skaya." "I've never met a Skrang," said Emile with a faraway smile. "I've been told they're fine fighters." "This one is," Jury confirmed. "Well, my dear, I can't offer you anything as exotic as a Skrangish swordsman's opposition, but would you do the honor of facing me? I don't have many students these days, but then I wouldn't presume to teach an established duelist." He added with a mischievous little grin. "Call it a lesson for me, or call it humoring a feeble old man, whichever you like." Jury considered this odd request for a moment, then gave a mental shrug. "Why not?" she replied. "I'll have to borrow equipment." "Oh, I've plenty of that. You'll find the changing room through that door." Emile Charbonneau was old, but he was hardly feeble. After 4 furious clashes with him, 1 win, 1 draw, and 2 losses, Jury could only hope with all her heart that when she reached the fine old age of 140, she was half as spry and enjoyed her life half as much. It wasn't until she'd finished drying and combing her hair. No way to put it back into its curls here, so she'd just have to let it go natural until she got back to the hotel, and strapped her watch back on, that Jury realized how late it had gotten. Goodness, it was nearly 6. By the time she got back to the Hotel des Deux Îles, even assuming she could find her way readily out of this maze of little streets, Caitlin would be back. "Ah, well," she thought as she buttoned her blouse. It was worth it for this strange little encounter with the ghost of Charbonneau. She emerged from the changing room with her coat over her arm to find old Emile waiting for her in the studio, dressed in a neat, slightly old-fashioned suit, with a smile on his face and a long package under his arm. "My dear, you are superb," he told her. "Don't let an old man's luck discourage you. I'll be feeling your riposte in my shoulder for the next week," he added, his smile widening into a slightly conspiratorial grin. "I hope you won't curse me for it," Jury replied, smiling in return. "Not at all. It'll be a pleasant reminder of the most stimulating afternoon I've had in a long time. Why, if I didn't know better, I would swear I'd trained you myself." He winked. "That's my old ego talking. Now," he went on briskly, "before you go back into the world, my dear, and leave old Charbonneau behind, there's something I'd like you to have." He handed her the package, and even before lifting the lid and looking inside, Juri already knew what she would find. It was a broadsword. Paradoxically, a rather narrow one, but a broadsword all the same, double-edged and pointed, with an arched brass crossguard, just like the one Charbonneau had given her back home when they'd parted, the day before he'd thrown himself off the Bayshore Bridge. It had been his, a prize he'd won at some tournament or other. He'd never had any... "I won that," said Emil, "in 2342 at the World Championships in Prague. Never had any use for it, but it sounds as though you have, and so I'd like you to take it with you." Juri closed the box and put it under her arm, then looked at the kindly faced oldster, so different, and yet so much the same as the harsh but talented man who had been the first of her two great teachers. "I don't know what to say, Monsieur Charbonneau," she said, her voice hushed. "Don't say anything," said Emile, and he put his arm around her shoulders, a gesture of familiarity she wouldn't have tolerated from most people, even harmless-looking old men, and led her to the front door. "Just remember, old Emile, as you make your way in this world. The pop philosophers tell us never to look back, but I find that a quick glance over the path I've taken so far helps me to keep my bearings." He smiled, patted her on the back, and then pointed. "Head that way, take your first left, and you'll find the Rue Dauphine. You should be able to find your way from there." "Monsieur Charbonneau, I..." said Juri, and then she trailed off. "I what? What was there to say in a situation like this?" This man had found a piece that her Charbonneau, brilliant and tortured, had never managed to find. Was this some kind of an omen? An indication that she could have ended up like the one she knew, but now she had a chance to find the kind of peace and longevity this one had? Only she didn't believe in omens, did she? Emil smiled. "Au revoir, Mademoiselle Juri," he said, and closed the door behind her. Feeling slightly dazed, Juri followed his directions, and before long she was in the Place Dauphine. She went to the brasserie where she and Caitlin had eaten their first meal in Paris, had a glass of water, and then walked to the Ile Saint-Louis. Kate was already back, showered and changed when she arrived back in room 2305. She looked up from her book as Juri entered and smiled as widely as the redhead had ever seen her. "In interesting change," she said. "Guess what?" "What?" Juri replied. "Monsieur Chalfant made the final selections today. My piano sonata is going to be one of the main solo performances tomorrow." "Really? Well, congratulations," said Juri. "That's wonderful." Kate beamed. "I can't wait to tell Miki," she said. Then she noticed Juri's oblong burden and inquired, "What's in the box? "I've just had a very odd afternoon," said Juri, and she sat down on her bed and told Caitlin all about it. "Hmm," said Kate thoughtfully. That must feel really surreal. I'll understand if you'd rather lay low tonight." No, not at all," said Juri. "I'm all right. I was just a bit stunned, I guess the word would be. Of all the people to encounter at random in this city." She shook her head. "I'll be fine. We have to celebrate your victory over Raglan. And besides, it's your birthday," she added, smiling. "I can't leave you to wander around alone on your birthday, or keep you cooped up in here. What would you like to do?"
Well, said Kate, "we've been in Paris for 5 days now, and we still haven't been to the Eiffel Tower. I think that's technically a crime.
"All right," said Juri. "The tower it is. But first I have something I want to show you." She picked up the telephone, dialed the front desk, and said, "This is Miss Arisugawa in 2305.
Will you please send up my deliveries now? Thank you. Caitlin was both embarrassed and pleased at the compact but comprehensive wardrobe Jury had assembled for her over the course of her day's shopping. She repeatedly protested, as Jury had her try everything on and gave her fitting and accessorizing tips, that Jury really shouldn't have gone to so much trouble and expense. But of course the redhead wouldn't hear of it. It was done now, and anyway, what was money for? There was certainly no protest from Kate on the way any of it looked, though. She discovered each new item with delight. When the impromptu fashion show was finished, she put on her favorite of the outfits for the evening. One of the shops Jury had visited had stylish variations on functional sweaters, of combed cotton in various colors that would never have been used in a working environment. The one that had caught Jury's eye, and now Caitlin's, was a modified version of a fisherman's sweater. The extremely soft black cotton had been knitted into two variations on the standard vertical cable style, with branching patterns framed between them that were reminiscent of a tree branching up the center and out over the upper torso and shoulders behind the cables. To further accent the impression of the tree, highlights of orange and red were knitted in an almost random distribution that resolved, at a small distance, into leaves on the branches. Around the hem of the sweater, which fell mid-thigh on Caitlin, yarn of a soft pale gray was worked in to provide a ground for the tree, reminiscent of snow. Chevrons of the gray and black cotton barred the sleeves. To go with the sweater, Jury had found charcoal gray silken slacks and a matching silk scarf, almost transparent, to knot around Kate's neck and accent the boat neckline of the sweater. She had also found a black and orange purse made from an old silk kimono in an accessories shop, and low-heeled character dance shoes. The straps over the tops of Kate's feet were just covered by the hem of the slacks. While Kate admired herself in the closet door mirror, Jury took a few minutes to put the curls back in her hair, and then off they went to the Eiffel Tower. They re-entered the lobby of the Hotel des Deux Îles at around 10:30, laughing over some joke shared on the way back from the metro stop on the Ile de la Cité, when Caitlin paused in surprise. A stocky man who looked to be in his early 20s was leaning against the wall next to the elevator, his hands in the pockets of his jeans, pinning back the tails of a long green trench coat. His face was obscured by a black fedora hat, since he seemed to be examining the toe of one of his red and black sneakers. He looked up as they entered, and Jury noticed that he resembled Caitlin and her brother Corwin a bit. Another brother, perhaps, this one college-aged? But Jury could have sworn she'd heard someone mention that Caitlin was the eldest. The man pushed himself away from the wall and marched briskly across the room, a smile breaking out on his open, slightly whiskery face. Kate took a couple of trotting steps and met him, falling into his embrace with a happy little sound. "What are you doing here?" she asked him in standard, sounding immensely pleased. Jury arched an eyebrow in surprise. Caitlin hadn't stuttered at all addressing this fellow, whoever he was. "I came to wish my best girl a happy birthday, of course," he replied with a grin. "What else?" She went a little pink and said, "Don't let Mom hear you say that." Then she turned to indicate Jury. "Dad? This is my friend, Jury Arisugawa. She is Dorothy's roommate back at WPI and used to go to Utena's old school. Jury, this is my father. Ben Hutchins," said he, offering a hand. "Most people call me Griffin, but you don't have to if you don't want. I'm not militant about it," he added, grinning. "Charmed," said Jury, shaking the offered hand. "This man was Caitlin's father? He looked, at most, 5 years older. But hadn't someone, Dorothy maybe, mentioned something about extended lifespans in Caitlin's family? She couldn't remember for certain, but she had the impression that the family name was a fairly prominent one here in this world. She would have to do more research. "Did you guys just eat?" Griffin asked. Informed that they had, he shook his head. "Just the luck. Ah, well. Is there some place around here I can buy you a drink at, anyway? I think you're old enough for it now, in France, anyway, if you want one." Kate didn't have the heart to tell him she'd already had her inaugural drink, both unofficially, at the Brasserie Dauphine on Sunday night,
and officially in the Jules Verne restaurant on the second floor of the Eiffel Tower just now. Instead, she smiled and said she thought the Brasserie Dauphine was still open. "I'll let you two have some time to yourselves," said Jury. "It was nice meeting you, Mr. Hutchins." Griffin winced. "Are all your friends going to insist on calling me that, Kate?" he wondered. "Probably," Kate told him. In his 431 years of life to date, Benjamin Hutchins had learned a great many languages. Some of them he had learned out of practical necessity. Seleucian, for example, the better to communicate with the WDF's oldest and staunchest allies. Others he had learned for the sake of convenience, like Vulcan, a common language of learning, particularly in starship engineering and warp propulsion circles. Still others he had picked up just by whim, because he enjoyed languages and collected them like some people collected hats or coins. What other reason could anyone have for learning Esperanto? Somehow, though, in all his years of linguistic pursuit, he had missed out French. It was very possibly the only major Earth language he didn't know, but his ignorance of it was profound. He could pronounce place names passably, so he wasn't a complete ugly American. "Pardonnez moi, monsieur. How can I get to the Isle de la City from here? Do I have to take the Champs Ulysses?" But ordering in a brasserie was a bit beyond him, so Kate took care of that. The three inspectors from the Quai des Orfèvres were in their usual booth, and raised their glasses in cheerful greeting as Kate entered. Marcel Janvier bustled over. Like all good publicans, he was an expert bustler, and though he was a bit disappointed that Kate had already eaten and hadn't brought with her the most charming Miss Jury, he at least prevailed upon her to accept a bottle of Beaujolais as a birthday gift. It is perhaps not the world's most sophisticated wine, but it is very accessible. Griffin let her order, and before long he was nibbling at bits of fried mozzarella and smiling nostalgically at his eldest daughter over a pint of the establishment's own dark beer. "So," he said, "how are things going? Good conference this year?" Kate nodded. "Yeah, it's been great. The usual wrangles with Ragolin, his bunch from the École Musico-Pretentious, but nothing too bad." She grinned broadly and added, "Monsieur Chalfont picked Sonata No. 14 in G to be one of the main solo performances for tomorrow." "That's great," said Griffin, beaming. He jumped up from his seat, rounded the table, and caught her up in a hug, right there in the brasserie. "Congratulations. You'll be playing it yourself?" "Mm-hmm," she said. "It'll be the world premiere. Although..." She glanced at the upright piano in the corner and smiled. "Monsieur Janvier?" she inquired in French. "Yes," the patron replied from behind his counter. "May I borrow your piano?" "Go right ahead," said Janvier with a smile. "It's been waiting for you since last year." Kate went to it, noting that if nobody played it, at least Janvier or Madame Janvier kept it clean. The key cover was shining and dustless as Caitlin slid it back and bared the keyboard. She settled herself behind the keys, composed herself for a moment, and then began to play. The sonata was 22 minutes long and composed of three parts: a light, sparkly allegro, a somber, gloomy, but hopeful-feeling adagio, and a furious, striving presto that thundered like a freight train toward a glorious release. To Griffin, the whole thing sounded a bit like what his life from 1991 to 2388 would have sounded like if it had been compressed into a 22-minute piano sonata, which was, in fact, the basic idea. Applause broke out as Caitlin finished, slightly flushed, and closed down the piano again. Plump, smiling Madame Janvier came out from the kitchen to join in with her husband and the three detectives from the Quai, who were all on their feet. Now she blushed outright, but took a bow anyway, then waved off their continued applause with an abashed smile, and went back to the table, where her father, too, stood clapping. "Enough, enough," she said, gesturing him back into his seat as she took her own. Just then Madame Janvier brought him his steak and fussed about how proud he must be of his beautiful and talented daughter, who would no doubt go far. He assured the good lady, as best he could, using that freshly embarrassed daughter as translator, that he was indeed just as proud as he could be. "It's funny," Caitlin observed, taking a drink of her beer and savoring the rich, dark bitterness. "I can perform in front of a crowd of hundreds without turning a hair, get up there and play and sing and jump around with the art of noise, and it never bothers me, but an intimate little gathering like this..."
"Oh, well, back to work," grumbled Superintendent Marquette as he got to his feet. "Come on, boys. 20 masks won't catch himself. On your feet, Luca."
"Slave driver," complained Sergeant Luca good-naturedly. "Do you think we should stand for this treatment, LaFontaine?" Dark-eyed LaFontaine smiled sardonically at her slightly chubby colleague and replied, "I think Janvier ought to hire the young lady so we can have entertainment of that caliber in here every night." When they had gone, Griffin smiled across the table at Caitlin and said, "So you're enjoying your trip?"
"Immensely," Kate replied. "The conference has been going well, and jury..."
She paused, fumbling for an explanation that wouldn't take all night.
"I really like her, Dad," she said after a few moments' thought. "I mean, as more than just a friend. You know what I mean?"
Griffin grinned gently. Back at Christmas time, when Kate and her roommate had taken to sleeping together, he had wondered to his daughter about the nature of that interaction, not out of concern, merely curiosity, wondering how they stood and whether he ought to show a bit more discretion in their presence. She told him it wasn't as it appeared, because Utrina wasn't into that sort of thing. That they were very, very close, in many ways, but not sexually. It had come out in the conversation that ensued, though, that Kate thought she herself probably would be interested if the right girl came along. It was hypothetical, since that girl hadn't come along so far, but... Her father, for his part, hadn't been upset, or even particularly shocked. Once upon a time, when he'd been her age, he might have been. Rural Maine in the 20th century wasn't the best of places to get a cosmopolitan view of the world's variations on a theme, but that had been before the wedge and the hundreds of years of eye-opening life that had come with it. So he just told her to tread carefully and try to be as sure as she could before taking any great plunges that she was doing the right thing for her, and to bring her troubles to him if she had any, so that he could do whatever he could to help. "I know," he said, nodding. Then, wryly, he added, "I once met a redhead who had a similar effect on me, too." Caitlin chuckled a bit at that, though her eyes were still serious as she went on. "I don't know if she'd be interested, though. I don't know her well enough yet to ask about that kind of thing. But maybe. I think Utina said once the jury had a girlfriend back where they came from, or maybe it was just that she wanted one. I can't remember exactly how it went. That was back before Christmas, and I was paying more attention to what Utina was saying about herself. I didn't think I'd meet the other people she was talking about." She sighed. "Anyway, if that was true, then maybe I have a chance. What do you think?"
"I think it's best if you don't fret," he said, reaching across the table to pat her hand. "Or rush. You've got a long time ahead of you for that kind of thing to work itself out."
Kate smiled. "I know. I'm not lonely, exactly. I have a lot of friends, really good friends, and Newton is the best friend and the best roommate in the universe, but..." She reddened a little. Griffin chuckled. "I know what you're trying to say. But that's the sort of thing that's better left to develop on its own, rather than trying to engineer it. Trust me, just let it ride. It's better spontaneous, but unhurried, too." He added with a rather sly grin. "Hadn't you and Mom known each other for something like a week?" Kate asked dryly. "That was very spontaneous," Griffin admitted with mock chagrin. "But I'll have you know there was no hurry," he added with equally mock indignation. "Why, we wasted most of a day on it." That broke them up laughing, and as he polished his bar, the patron smiled. He had no idea what they were talking about,
but it was good to see a father and daughter so close as that, whatever the topic. The fellow was young-looking, but what else could he be but her father, the way he looked at her? Marcel Janvier had 3 daughters himself. He knew. "Seriously, hon," said Griffin when they'd finished. "I know this is going to sound as stupid to you as it did to me when my father said it, long ago when dinosaurs ruled the earth, but..." He paused, then went on slowly, halting now and again to corral his thoughts for the next bit. Caitlin finished her beer and waited patiently. She knew better than most how hard it could be to line your thoughts up and push them out across your tongue, after all. As he said, "If it's a thing that ought to be, then it'll work out. Don't try to force it. Just be the best friend you can, and if you have an opportunity to let it be known that you wouldn't mind being more than that, then let it be known and see what happens. It might work and it might not, but at least then you'll know. And if it doesn't, then that's not the end of everything." He grinned sheepishly, ran his hand back across his hair, and went on, "Listen to me. I sound like I'm reading out of a book. How to Give Your Kids the Talk, or some such foolishness." Kate nodded. "Mm-hmm." Then she reached across the table and took his free hand, smiling. "But I understand what you're trying to say, and I appreciate it. I want you to be happy, Kate, however you can," Griffin told her, looking as serious as she'd ever seen him. "I worry that you're..." This part was very hard. He slowed almost to a crawl. "Your past experiences will tarnish what comes after them. You know, there's a lot of joy to be had in this world if you can dodge the rocks. He sighed, and suddenly the words rushed out of him as though the sigh had dislodged the obstruction that had held them back. "I'm torn, Caitlin. I want you to be careful, because it'd kill me if anything like that happened to you again. But at the same time, I don't want you to be paranoid, because if you are, you'll cheat yourself out of the joy that life can bring if you're open to it. Part of me wants to be the sort of black comedy father who guards his daughter like a bank vault, screening her friends like they're applying for a job in data security. But the rest of me knows that you have to live your own life, and trying to protect you that way would only make you hate me. I try to stay out of your way, and then I worry I'm neglecting you. I try to watch over you, and then I worry I'm crowding you." He shook his head. "Now I'm not making any sense." He offered her a wry grin and said in mock complaint, "Man, this parent thing is hard." Kate chuckled and squeezed his hand. "I understand, Dad. Really, I do. And I want you to know that I'm not going to let what happened to me poison the rest of my life." She met his eyes, steady and smiling. "I'm not very bold," she said, "and that's both an advantage and a disadvantage. But I get by, Dad. I have a lot of good friends, people who are there for me, to help me dodge the rocks, as you put it. I have the Federation, I have Utna, I have Corwin, I have Marty and Aiko and Mom. And I have my father, who loves me and frets about me, and wants me to be happy." She got partway up, leaned across the table, and kissed his cheek. "And I love him for it all." Griffin smiled, looking like he was about to get a little teary-eyed. Then he got up, paid the check, and left the Brasserie Dauphine with his arm around his daughter's shoulders. He walked her to the door of the Hotel des Deux Îles in comfortable silence, and then, on the sidewalk outside, hugged and kissed her goodbye. "Good luck tomorrow," he said. "Wish I could be there. And your mom, too. Oh, I almost forgot," he added, looking rueful. He reached into the pocket of his coat and took out a small box, then handed it to her. "These are for you." Kate took the box and opened it in the pool of golden light cast by the hotel's front lamp, then made a delighted little sound. Inside was a pair of earrings, little silver maple leaves, perhaps the size of a dime. "I know how much you like Canada," her father said, "and even though you already got your big present, I couldn't come and see you empty-handed on her birthday."
Caitlin balanced the box in her hand and put on first one of the earrings, then the other. Then she tucked the box into her pocket and hugged her father again.
"Thank you," she murmured. "Thanks for everything. I love you, Dad."
"I love you too, Kate," he replied. "Happy birthday." When they parted, both smiling and a little misty-eyed, he patted her shoulder and said, "Boy, those go well with that sweater. Did you pick it out?"
"No. Jury kind of bought me a wardrobe for my birthday. She's got a lot of style, and I guess she decided I needed some fancier clothes."
She ran her hands down the sleeves and smiled. "It's all nice, but this is my favorite piece."
"It's beautiful," said Griffin, nodding. "I guess she must like you a little if she gave you something like that," he added with a sly grin.
Kate reddened a little and whacked him in the shoulder. He took the opportunity to hug her once more, and said, "Well, good night, hon, and good luck in whatever you do." She grinned, patted his hand on her shoulder, and then turned and went into the hotel. Griffin stood for a moment on the misty sidewalk, then walked away up the Rue Saint-Louis-en-L'Île, whistling Harlem Nocturne.